And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Okay, if you had to list the top 10 worst things for planet Earth, what would they be? I'm sure some right now might include the irritating voices of the chipmunks from the new movie, pay toilets, overdraft charges. Well, today we feature the top 10 list of worst things for planet Earth. We also hear from Donna Buckby with the latest on the town of Rushford, Minnesota, and how it's now coping with recovering from the floods that rushed forward through their little town. And we hear what presidential candidate John Edwards has to say about the environment and more. It's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The 2 weeks coming up are probably some of the busiest of the year. We're on the final descent to Christmas, and then that strange week of moving sideways to the new year. With so much going on, and with so much to look forward to in 2008, I thought at the right time to think about the top 10 worst things for planet Earth, with the hopes that we can follow this up with the top 10 best things for planet Earth to start the new year right. That's coming up in segment 2, following a special Nature News update. We'll be heading up to Rushford, Minnesota. Remember that little town that almost got washed away by massive flooding? We'll get an update from our regular guest, Donna Buckby, on how the town is making progress. That's coming up in segment 2. But it's time now to bring you up to date by the world's most significant voices on the Earth. So now it's time for the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and today we bring you the final of the three presidential candidate statements delivered at a special forum in San Francisco about global climate change and the environment. What are we supposed to think about our democracy when one of the most critical issues facing not only our nation but the world continues to receive so little attention? We are, of course, talking about global climate change and the environment. There has been one attempt to discuss this issue, and all candidates from both parties were invited to share their concerns and views. Three showed up. In the interest of providing perspectives on the future of the Earth, we have already featured Hillary Clinton and Dennis Kucinich, who attended this event in San Francisco, and now bring you the final presentation by John Edwards. So now, I bring you without interruption, John Edwards on global climate change and the environment.
Thank you, thank you. And let me say a personal thank you to all of you. It's great to be here with my friends from the League of Conservation Voter Education Fund, the California LCV, National Resources Defense Council, and the Center for American Progress Action Fund. You all have been at the forefront of fighting global warming. And this forum is another one of many examples of your doing what's necessary to raise awareness about this issue, raise awareness about this crisis, and to inject it into the center of the debate, which it should be in this campaign and this election. You know, I'm not here to tell the people who know very well that global warming is a crisis, that it is a crisis. You already know that. But I am here to tell you we need a president of the United States who won't just deliver that message to a friendly audience, which is what you are. We need a president who will be straight with the American people about the challenges and the opportunities that all of us face when it comes to global warming. A week ago on Veterans Day, I talked about the sacrifices of America's finest, those who gave life for our country, who made the ultimate sacrifice to preserve our way of life. I believe that today, our generation, all of us, we owe it to them and to our children to face some hard truths. One of those truths is that the system in Washington, D.C. is broken. And there is no better example of that than global warming. Now, thanks to the hard work, and I heard Senator Clinton speaking about this, thanks to the hard work of Vice President Al Gore, we all know, and the world now knows, that global warming is in fact a crisis. We know that the need for action is urgent, and we know that the steps we need to take are right in front of us. All we have to do is have a little backbone and courage to actually do it. But Washington is not taking them. And when I look at Washington today, I see politicians who are too afraid of rocking the boat to face up to the challenges in front of us. I see good people who are caught up in a bad system that overwhelms their best intentions. I see elected leaders trying to do the right thing for the people they represent, but they are overrun because of the need to spend half of their time chasing the money they need to be elected and reelected. And I see the oil and gas companies blocking progress by spending millions of dollars and deploying hundreds of lobbyists in Washington to make sure that America stays addicted to foreign oil and fossil fuels. Meanwhile, more and more evidence that global warming is here is piling up. We now know that the Arctic ice cap could literally be gone in 23 years. Just yesterday, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change followed up on its groundbreaking reports from earlier this year with a warning that global warming will have abrupt and irreversible consequences if we're not willing to act immediately. That's more evidence than any politician should ever need. And yet, 2 weeks from now, America will send a delegate to the United Nations conference in Bali with no ideas and no solutions. It is embarrassing for the United States of America to be in that position. Throughout this campaign, I've been very clear about what I think we need to do to face this challenge. I'm proud of the fact that I came out very early and very aggressively about what we need to do to attack global warming. I said then that we need to cap greenhouse gas pollution starting in 2010 with a cap and auction system, and that we need to reduce it by 20% by 2020 and 80% by 2050, that we need to lead the world in a new global climate treaty, that we need to meet the demand for more electricity through efficiency for the next decade instead of producing more electricity. And we need to create a new energy economy fund to support U.S. research and development in energy technology and other advances by auctioning off $10 billion of greenhouse pollution permits and repealing $3 billion in oil company subsidies. Now, I have heard some politicians talk about a cap and trade system as not going far enough, as a way to avoid the word tax. But I believe that candidates running for president need to be straight with the American people about exactly what we're proposing. We've had enough double talk. We've had enough politician talk. We need to be honest with people. The truth is that carbon caps will have an impact on the cost of fossil fuels. Anyone who pretends that's not true is not being straight with America. And by the way, it is a political strategy that is absolutely doomed to failure, because we are never going to get the change we need by pretending that this is going to be easy and that no sacrifice will be required. The truth is that the big change we need will not be easy. It'll take the sustained commitment of a generation of Americans. The American people understand that, and we need a president who will challenge them to be part of the solution, not patronize them by pretending that the problem doesn't exist or that some politician can solve it for them. Back in March, only 2 days after I had announced my own global warming plan, as many of you know, Elizabeth and I sat in a hospital room and made the decision to continue with this campaign. We made that decision because both of us believed that fighting for a better America, fighting to make sure we pass a better world on to our children, is the cause of our lives. The fact that the challenges now rising up around us loom larger now than they did back then has only strengthened our resolve to continue with this effort, to keep on telling the truth about the problems we face and what it's going to take to fix those problems. Right now, we're not just turning a blind eye to global warming. We're also missing an opportunity to lead the world and reclaim the spirit of American ingenuity that has driven great advances and helped us overcome great challenges in the past. Right now, we're sitting by the side of the road as foreign companies race ahead with developing green technology. Bell Labs invented the solar cell in New Jersey in 1954. But today, 90% of solar panels are manufactured overseas. China's even produced a solar billionaire. General Motors made the first modern electric car, but today Toyota and Honda lead the world in producing hybrids. Just last week I saw this headline: foreign firms envision wind farms dotting the U.S. Why should foreign firms be the ones taking the lead in building wind farms here in America? Why is that not being done by American firms? If we take the steps that I propose, American entrepreneurs and manufacturers can lead the world in developing the green technology we need to generate clean, reliable energy and to use it more efficiently. There are so many ways that we can seize this opportunity and unleash America's innovators to lead the way into the new energy economy. We need to let entrepreneurs try 1,000 different approaches, not centrally planned government handouts. Let me give you a few examples of exactly what I mean. First, I will cut carbon welfare subsidies for oil companies to raise money that will be invested in renewable fuels like wind, solar, biofuels, and turbocharging our energy efficiency technology. Second, I'll spark a new era of innovation and competition by modernizing our electricity grids. New smart grids will let entrepreneurs create renewable energy and then to sell it back into the grid. They'll also be safer, more efficient, and more reliable. Third, I will seed innovation by giving low-interest loans to homeowners and small businesses for new technologies like solar, hot water, and electric systems. These systems are expensive, as all of you know up front, but they pay off for families in the long run, particularly when excess power can be sold to their neighbors. Fourth, I'll create a new market for energy efficiency. Right now, utilities profit from selling electricity, but have absolutely no incentive to help their customers use less energy. I will call on states to separate utilities' energy profits from their sales, as California has done, so that they can profit by meeting customers' needs with more efficient technology. Now, don't get me wrong, getting to the new energy future that all of us want to see happen for this country that we love so much will not be a cakewalk. It's true that the steps we have to take will cost money. It's true that some of these steps we need to take will meet higher energy prices. And given the scope of the crisis, there may be further steps that we need to take down the road. Every time we get new, up-to-date scientific information, it indicates that global warming is more a crisis than we thought before. But in the end, families can come out ahead if they switch to renewable fuels, use energy efficiently, and make smaller sacrifices in their own lives. I think we're ready for that. I think, actually, the American people are ready for a president who calls on them to sacrifice and asks them to be patriotic about something other than war. Because I believe we are at a critical point in this country's history. It's a place we've found ourselves before. Those who've gone before us have climbed bigger hills. My parents' generation crossed the Atlantic, went into Europe, freed Europe, and defeated Hitler and fascism. They went across the Pacific and defeated Japan. Then they came home and built the Pentagon, one of the biggest buildings in the world, in less than a year. And they built the great American middle class, the great engine of economic growth that the world has never seen duplicated. Those who have come before us have climbed the hills of inequality and fought the battle for civil rights. They've outlasted the dark force of communism. They've lived through recessions and energy crisis and the Great Depression. And every time they have proven that if we stand up and face the challenges in front of us, a better future will be our reward. This is the moral test of our generation. Will we leave our children a better world than we found, as our parents and our grandparents did? If we intend to pass this test, we have to ask ourselves a basic question. Are we willing to put political calculation aside and actually stand up with a little backbone for what's right? Are we willing to say that the time for compromise and half measures is over, and that now is the time for our party, the Democratic Party, to be bold, to stand up for what it is we actually believe in. When we look at our children in the eye and they ask us what happened, well, we have to tell them that we left this mess for them because the challenges were just too great. And we were too careful, too timid, too cautious. We didn't have the guts to do what needed to be done. Or will we be able to look them in the eye and say, in the face of great challenges, we, our generation, all of us, we stood up. We did what 20 generations of Americans have done before us. We knew that we had a responsibility to them and future generations to preserve the planet. That's our responsibility. If we choose the right path, if we make smart choices today, we can create the better America that all of us dream about. We can have a prosperous middle class while preserving our natural resources and the beauty of our planet. We can get America off its addiction to oil. We can show the world that our response to adversity is not to stick our head in the sand, not to cower in the corner, but to unleash a new era of American ingenuity, just like we have done in the past and just like our fathers and grandfathers have done before us. That is the future at the top of the hill. It's going to take courage. It's going to take resolve. We're going to have to leave behind political calculation. But we're Americans, and the American people have never, ever shrunk from a challenge. And I don't think we're going to start now. Thank you all, and God bless you.
I think it's proper that we take special note of these three presidential hopefuls, Dennis Kucinich, Hillary Clinton, and John Edwards, for taking the time to address this critical issue at the recent global climate crisis and environmental debate in San Francisco. We'll continue to bring you the week's leading voices each week here on the Weekly Earth Summit. How does a modern Minnesota farm community cope when an epic flood rages through their small rural town? We revisit the town of Rushford, Minnesota, then bring you the top 10 list of the worst things for planet Earth when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
If you had to list the top 10 worst things that this planet of ours is facing in the years ahead, what would they be? Get out a paper and write them down during the break and compare them to our top 10 list of the worst things for planet Earth and find out what's happening to Rushford, Minnesota, slammed by massive floods just a few months back. How are they recovering? You'll find that out and more when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. This past week, the Midwest was crippled by a fierce winter storm that took out power and made everyone just stop for a few days to retake their control from good old Mother Nature. 3 months ago, a small rural town in Minnesota was hit by a massive rain-caused flood that took out much of the town, the homes, the businesses, schools, and churches. Following on the Katrina legacy of broken promises, the town of Rushford is now in the midst of winter and continuing to try to recover. In just a moment, we'll be talking with Donna Buckby about Rushford. And then, we'll begin to put our wrap on this year as we bring you the top 10 list of the worst things for planet Earth. That's coming up. But first, the news. The Bali Conference on Global Warming has adjourned amid 2 weeks of rancorous and sometimes direct confrontation between much of the world and their main protagonist, the United States of America, or at least the representatives representing the Bush White House. When all is said and done, an agreement was signed spelling out a consensus statement on how to proceed into the next 2 years of talks and negotiations. We'll be covering this in depth in the weeks ahead. As yet, it is so freshly out of the oven that it will take a while for it to cool down enough to get a sense of the final shape of the agreement. In September of this year, a small town in rural Minnesota was devastated by unusually heavy rains, much as Katrina did in New Orleans. We bring you this special news update on Rushford, Minnesota. Well, as we kind of begin to wrap up this year, I think it's important to follow those stories that have carried us along throughout the year. And one that I certainly have wanted to follow and therefore am is what happened to Rushford, Minnesota, a little town in southeastern Minnesota that got hit and really devastated by a terrible flood back in September of this year. Now, we've been following this story and kind of carrying it along by talking with the resident there, Donna Buckby. And Donna, I want to welcome you back to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Okay, here it is at least about 3 months later. Your town was really hit. You lost many homes and businesses and water and electricity, and it was really devastated, very much in the order of New Orleans in terms of the way in which you were hit with these floodwaters. At one point there, the store was wiped out, the schools were down, many people had lost their homes. The next kind of phase was that the store was maybe about ready to come back. FEMA had come in with some trailers. My concern was what might happen in the winter. Well, it's winter now, and so it's time to get an update from Donna Buckby. Donna, why don't you go ahead and give us your thoughts?
Well, a lot of people have hit a brick wall before the snow and cold weather hit. There was a lot of work, and people are still working, but they've got generators, and they're working out in the cold. But some of the stores came back, the grocery store and a couple of the restaurants, and that's nice, and the gas stations. But and other people rebuilding their homes, they're doing that. And some people are actually probably going to be able to move back in shortly. But that's few and far between. But a lot of other people, because the money isn't coming, they're in limbo, and they can't do anything. They've hit a brick wall, a lot of people.
What's the difference between those who seem to be in recovery and those who find themselves stranded right now?
Well, the loan applications, they're required to apply for small business loans, and we don't know why some of this is being held up, but it's been suggested that maybe the money that is supposed to be funneled through some of the state agencies is being held by those agencies. Again, Tim Pawlenty's.
That's the governor.
That's the governor, mm-hmm. Conservative, Republican governor, that the money might be held by those agencies so that when the legislature reconvenes in February and they will be asking for more money for the flood victims, then the state agencies can say, well, we really don't need to have more money because we still have money in the pipeline that people haven't applied for, or we still have it, so we don't need to raise taxes for this or reallocate funds. We've got money in the pipeline. But they're holding it. It's a logjam, and people aren't getting the money.
What's the mood? You know, I mean, there's probably many moods. Probably some people are saying, thank God, I'm kind of back on my feet. You know, we certainly want people to succeed. But what's the mood? Is there any tension in the town?
Some people are feeling like this is a class issue, too.
Now, how does that translate, a class issue?
Well, the haves are getting their money, and the haves are getting more money and their money faster. And the people who don't have money are, not getting.
I suppose based on credit ratings and things, so if you...
Maybe just help. So there are class issues in this town, but there was one business owner, I heard this rumor, and I can't verify, but I guess he was so upset that the sheriff or the mayor, someone had to take him on a long, slow drive to calm him down. And I don't know what he was going to do, but people are angry. They're just real angry.
That sounds like a wonderful movie, that the sheriff takes this troubled local on a long, slow drive to cool them down. That does not happen in many other parts of the country that I'm aware of.
Right, well, I guess this is a service provided to the people in Rushford, but
Well, everybody knows everybody. That is the case. And I know there was concern about some of the elders, people who may have lost their homes. Any news on what's happened to them?
They're living with family members. I do know one person in town, and we helped work on his home, too, and got some supplies for him. But he's rebuilding his dad's house, and I think it's almost done. I think they're going to be back in, and maybe even in time for Christmas.
Well, that would be great.
That is going to be great. Mm-hmm. It's just really going to make a difference for that whole extended family, that the elderly parents will be back in their home. But that's rare. And there was a guy, an acquaintance of mine, that just moved back to town from Hawaii. He'd been gone for 5 years and heard about the flood and came back to town, and he brought up a damaged house, and he has the skills to rebuild it. So he got a good deal on it. But he's got a generator, there's no electricity, but he's a carpenter, and he's in the process of rebuilding.
Do you mean to say that they still don't have electricity to all the homes restored?
No. There are certain parts of town, certain sections that don't have power.
Now, that's the one thing that doesn't make sense to me, that it seems to me that that's a basic, and if there was there before, unless there were underground cables and they just can't get around to recabling, do you know if there was underground cables or above ground?
Ask what the situation is, but no, not everyone has power. Some people do, but not everyone.
Yeah, you mentioned that some people are out there using generators.
That gets
to be kind of a long and arduous task in the winter.
Absolutely, and people who are moving into damaged homes, or they've maybe fixed up one small room in the house that they plan on living in while they're working on the rest of the house.
Mm. Now, where's all the labor coming from? Are people just plain learning the skills themselves and putting themselves to work, or are people coming from around other communities to find work?
Well, people are coming to find work. Some people are doing their own work, and then there's a lot of donated labor coming in, too.
Where's that coming from?
Well, there's Red Cross, and there's Lutheran Disaster Services, if I got that name right, and just people are coming in just as individuals and small groups of people. I guess with the grocery store, some people came in from western Minnesota and just donated their skills, and they just said, down the road, if you ever can pay us back, that's fine. We're not going to worry about it. So it's how wonderful that is, that people have come in and donated their skills and their time.
How about churches in the town?
Well, a lot of the churches still aren't up and running because they were damaged, but the Catholic Church, which is kind of, well, it's right across from the high school, and it's kind of on a little hill, that was where the soup kitchen was during the worst of the disaster for a couple months. And they had a really sweet Thanksgiving Day gathering, and we're hoping that there's going to be a Christmas Day gathering, too, because it's important for people to come together and share that. One thing you might find interesting, Ken Jumper, our local representative, called the Housing and Finance Committee down here to Rushford at the high school and had a meeting about a month ago. And the homeowners and business owners were there to bear witness to the struggles they're having. One woman said, "We didn't ask for this flood, but we are made to feel like we're being punished, that we were victims of this flood. We're feeling like we did something bad." And everyone in the auditorium went, mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, that's a good observation. I can really sense that. I can feel it in the nation. It's even true in terms of what has happened down in New Orleans. And other places, that these people become losers and, you know, people who are living off the dole. And quite honestly, there's only so much that you can bring to the table after a disaster like that, particularly financially.
Well, I'll tell you, a lot of people feel a bond to the people in New Orleans now because they know. They can see that there was a lot of victim blaming going on, and then where's the money for New Orleans? What's happened there? The same thing has happened in this town now. So it's an awakening, and it's knowledge for people.
Well, I guess an important thing to learn from this is the fact that some people put a racial component on why things weren't happening in New Orleans, And maybe what we could learn from this is that it may just be a generalized failure, that there is the system is in a state of a relative collapse and cannot deal with these kinds of problems, even a small town in Minnesota.
Exactly. Yes. Oh, well, I think there might have been a racial component with New Orleans. I wouldn't discount that.
And there could be. That's true.
The system isn't a state of failure. That's very true. And that's apparent. People in Rushford see that. Mm-hmm. That if you can't even deal with a small town that has been hard hit by a disaster, what's wrong? Just the loan application process. This is not right. Mm-hmm. And then another woman spoke out, and she was at the same meeting at the high school. And she's with the Lutheran Disaster Services Group, and she said she's worked with a lot of floods all around the region. And she said Southeast Minnesota has received an unprecedented amount of money with the legislative flood relief package. I mean, they haven't received it, but it's been designated. But she said a lot of people in the state are maybe angry about this unprecedented amount of money. But she said, in my experience, this has been an unprecedented flood. She said, in other cities, even with the Fargo flood at Grand Forks, she said it wasn't this bad. She said people in this town and a few of the other communities in Southeast Minnesota lost everything. The water didn't just come up maybe a foot in the kitchen. She said people here lost everything. I don't know, maybe some people around the state are not caring if Rushford and other of the communities in Southeast Minnesota, maybe they don't care that we're not getting the money and the money's stuck in the pipeline because they didn't get it when they were hard hit. But we really, this was an unprecedented amount of water.
Well, you're just a farm community. You know, it's a very fancy world right now, very fancy world, very expensive world. Things are happening so fast. I would guess that the number of iPods in your town is much less than, let's say, up in Minneapolis and St. Paul per capita. You know,
I'll bet.
Yeah, and that may make a difference. Thank you, by the way, for that update, and we'll keep in touch. But I'm just curious now, you are in Minnesota in cold country. There have been some storms coming through. Let's talk a little bit about what life in Minnesota is like as you're heading into the new year.
Well, I'm sitting in front of a blazing fire. I actually like winter, and it's beautiful. It's very cold, and I did go out last week to see the fireballs during the Gemini meteor shower, so late in the night. So I didn't see the fireballs. I did see some falling stars, shooting stars, but a friend of mine said he saw a giant fireball at 3:30 in the morning. So life is good in some ways. If you've done your homework, and we got the wood, and I milked the goats, I've got the sheep and the goats in the barn, and the chickens are warm, and the dogs and cats are happy. So in a lot of ways, for me, I didn't suffer the flood. Right now, life is okay.
Thanks so much. We'll keep in touch. Just hunker in and enjoy the holidays, and we'll talk again in the new year.
All right. Thanks a lot. Take care.
And that's the news. And a few announcements. Send us your list of the top 10 best things for planet Earth. And get ready for some important announcements about the Wildside News in the weeks and months ahead. We're getting ready to reach out and make a difference. Stay tuned. Well, as 2007 begins to come to a close, and we think on towards the new year, it's probably one of the better times to take stock of what we'll need to do to make a better world. And that's why today, I'm bringing you the top 10 list of the worst things for planet Earth. There's a lot of things on my long list, things like making lots of stupid junky stuff, which is naturally topped by consuming lots of junky stupid stuff. The long list included such things as fundamentalism of all sorts, which if you warped it just a bit included scientists who can't see the truth unless they can prove it in a controlled experiment. All in all, I came up with 29 of the worst things for the planet, one of which was kind of like Alice staring through the looking glass, as it included sitting for years at a computer screen. I could go on, but really, now it's time for this year's top 10 list of the worst things for planet Earth. Number 10. Mountaintop removal. I'm not sure who on Earth came up with this ghastly idea that somehow it was okay to head into the hills of West Virginia and Kentucky and other sacred places filled with lore and towns and wildlife and wonder, and then just rip off all the vegetation for miles and miles and miles, and then start blasting them to bits with huge explosives so that they could get down to a seam of coal, which you then scrape out and then continue on down to the next level. It's bad enough that hundreds of square miles of what once was a proud part of America's legacy has been reduced to ruin, comparable to the worst blitzkrieg ever set upon any people, except, of course, in this modern era of warfare, which is the best way to really understand this. What I think is even worse than the vicious destruction of whole communities, ecosystems, river basins, and historic places is the way in which such even feels at all legitimate at all. Mountaintop removal is at number 10 on the list of the worst things for the planet Earth, because it is happening right now to thousands of people, and almost no one says a word. It's the silence in response to such horror that bodes a dire future for the Earth, because if it can happen here, it will happen anywhere there are resources to mine. Number 9. Oceanic bottom trawling. Same concept, only out of sight, out of mind. The idea that in order to find an edible fish or two, it's okay to drag huge drag lines along vast areas of the ocean's floor, ripping up and destroying everything, then netting it up into massive wads of suffering creatures, hauling them up with nets to massive sorting bins where humans search through the scooped-up biomass to find things that can be killed and sent off to fish markets around the world. What's particularly dangerous to the planet is that this is what is needed to find edible things in the oceans, because we have dragged out 90% of all the edible fish that once swam in massive schools. That was the easy taking, and take we did, and now there are almost no sizable fish left in our oceans. And finding the remaining 10% requires a lot of searching, but everyone knows that there's always something living on the bottom of the sea. So scoop it up and sort it out for the few edibles and throw the rest back, broken, bleeding, and ripped from their ancient homes. It is, like mountaintop removal, a harbinger of things to come. Such as, so when the bottom creatures are all gone, then what? This is a problem that is fueled as much by foreign nations as our own. It begs for a global response. But, as things go, there is probably little chance for that. And that is what makes bottom trawling the 9th worst thing for planet Earth. Number 8 on the top 10 list of worst things for planet Earth, massive harvesting technologies. Fueling all of the massive taking to supply this overpopulated planet requires more, larger, no, massively larger, grand machines to rip up, cut out, pull out, pulverize, process, package, and plunder massive scoops of rock, bulldoze down whole forests in a single day, lay waste to ocean bottoms, squeeze oil from regions of sand. What is most dangerous to our Earth is that a single man is trained to drive these monsters of destruction into any place that requires the harvest, and in an hour do more damage than 500 hard-working men could do when humans actually touch the earth they rent. Not now. A man sits in a comfortable cab, and with simple twists of his hands and pushes of his feet, brings down in minutes what nature took millions of years to create. What is most dangerous to our planet is that it seems the great mechanical engineering geniuses see the challenge of making even larger and more powerful and pervasive purveyors of production to feed the hungry greed of the masters of machines their greatest challenge. The monsters keep coming, ever larger, now into the tamest jungles of Indonesia, in a taking that will only last a decade, until it is all gone. And then what machine will be invented to wrest from the rubble, yet some pretense for profit? Please, stop now. Number 7 on the top 10 list of worst things for planet Earth, the new China. Nothing against the Chinese people, but whoa, are we in for a day of reckoning, as the new China, with its politics of centralized production and distribution, to its 1.2 billion new consumers swarming into the megatropolises for stoves and televisions, sofas, windows, shower heads, new underwear, leather shoes, bed frames, pets, wallets, pianos, restaurants, neon lights, rock and roll, glistening new cars. It's a heady wanting that's caught hold. Now, if you held the reins of this exploding human consumption machine, with all of its attendant drives and lusts and fattening needs, would you, or even could you possibly do anything less than feed it all the good stuff that human beings come to want, or face the rampaging rage against the hands that try to hold them back? No, the new China has set out on a course that seems quite obvious. The taking will go wild on planet Earth to feed the needs of the new Chinese consumers, and it is a specter that threatens every corner of the planet, every romantic dream of peace and serenity that once filled the dreams of the mystics. Because the course is set now, it will create its own legacy, and in the years ahead, the whole world will know that China is very, very hungry for all the good stuff. Number 6 in the top 10 list of worst things for planet Earth. Misunderstanding animal intelligence. As someone trained as a biologist and a naturalist, I learned to understand animal communications based mostly on scientific studies. There has been much progress during my lifetime in the science of animal intelligence. Scientists have now begun to realize that some animals have a more complex capacity to solve problems, exhibit basic recognition skills, demonstrate some unusual capacities in pattern recognition and memory, and some scientists have begun to open the door to animal emotions. The influence of science in our perceptions and descriptions of animal intelligence have driven a huge, invisible wall between we humans and all other life on Earth. But in the process, we have sanctioned a holocaust of death and suffering to countless creatures who have, for millennia, managed to figure out all of the myriad complexities of life, from munching to mating. And they have because they contain a magnificent intelligence capable of great and amazing original and creative responses to the world around them. Lest anyone doubt this, tune into Animal Planet and watch any of the shows which feature videos of animals doing what animals do. Spend a few hours, spend a month of spare time watching, and you will see an endless expression of awareness, comprehension, cleverness, playfulness, tenderness, abilities, agilities that animals exhibit now that they are being raised in situations which free them from perpetual wariness or the quest for food or mates and safety. Animals living with and within human communities are demonstrating each day their great creative spirits as they figure out how to open doors and windows, throw frisbees and catch them, hang out with their friends in the home, humans, dogs, cats, fish, birds, mice, all looking each other in the eyes, communicating an awareness between species and a capacity to communicate unlimited variations on how to get along, how to cohabit, how to have fun, how to protect, how to save, how to perform miraculous acrobatics. There is a whole new world, a new Eden of peace and play, communication and sharing that the animal world is always ready to share. True friendships are forming between members of all species, and the reality that they are communicating one with another is profoundly evident. When we open our eyes to theirs, our worlds to theirs, our souls to theirs, we will find an endless richness of experience, joy, wonder, and peace, the likes of which we have only begun to explore. As we ignore this reality, and as we continue to decimate whole sectors of creatures, each of which has the capacity to befriend us, we are creating much more than that scary science term, mass extinction. We are destroying the great spirit that abounds. Time is running out, and that is one of the worst things for planet Earth. Number 5. The fifth thing on the top 10 list of worst things for planet Earth is the exploitation of nature. We are shamelessly devouring nature everywhere. If God were here to speak to us, the many gods of man and woman from all corners of the earth would say, "You are destroying all of the riches which we have provided. Look around at the beauty everywhere. Do you think it is right to destroy the miraculous beauty upon which all life is formed? It is wrong. For you, the naked creature, who must make your own clothes, to not adore the clothes of the fish you slaughter, the birds whose homes you destroy to make your own, the happy sounds of the community of animals which stretches unbroken throughout the realms of the earth. You have become so heady in your self-awareness that you are blind and deaf to the teeming wonder of it all. This world was not made by you or for you. You were made in the image of the truth and within the law. You now think you live above the law, and nothing lives above the law for long. The world was not made for our taking. In fact, the less we take, the more we receive, freely given in a divine manifestation of balance and beauty, the breath of the divine. We have lost our way as we plunder our way through the wonder. And this is the fifth worst thing for planet Earth. Number 4 on the top 10 list of worst things for planet Earth. Consolidation of wealth and power. This consolidation of wealth into a few human wills and the associated power which these few humans control assumes that this represents the highest and best that humans can attain. But this is a sorry excuse for truth. Because life on Earth relies on diversity, in which all creatures, great and small, play their part. Is the stallion with the power to pull a wagon of gold greater than the oats which sustain it? Should the whale own the oceans, for no creature is greater and more powerful than it? And yet it siphons the smallest of creatures through its baleen smile. And what of the tallest, grandest tree in the forest, which has sucked up the minerals from the soil to build its fortress? When it dies, it falls and returns the wealth to the earth for other great trees yet to sprout and grow. But now wealth is concentrated into the masters of money, as if that and that alone was the entitlement of greatness. But it is, in fact, only a token of greatness for those who collect and hoard it. But there are mere children who write poems that touch the golden thread, and artists who pull beauty from a single piece of stone. There are singers whose voices enkindle the heart in ways no bankroll will ever compare. And yet, the great moneyed masters buy history as if they owned it, history forged out of sweat, blood, and tears of the labors of the creative masses. We all know the game. We all know the cost. A day may come when a great reckoning of justice by and for the people may rise to restore balance and peace amongst a worthy, happy people. And because that day of reckoning, if it comes, will pit the great forces of power against the great forces of people, this concentration of wealth and power ranks as the fourth worst thing for planet Earth. Number 3 on the top 10 list of worst things for planet Earth. Globalization. Is water a good thing? Without it, we will die in 3 days. Too much of it, and we will die in 3 minutes. Is red a worthy color? Yes, it is the color of rubies and strawberries. But in a world where everything must be red, there would be no emeralds or oranges. Globalization is a dream that goes back centuries. The vision of a world at peace is a global vision, but there is also a world of war, World War I, World War II, World War III. Globalization is about standardization of money, finance, trade, currencies, laws, regulations, lawmakers, justice, prisons. For the utopian dreamers of a one-world way, as long as it's their way, well, we have hardly begun to talk about the real effects of globalization. Who will run this thing? And who will hold the right? And who will be wrong? And why? Each of us knows directly the folly of conformity. All we need do is look at our own families. I have never, ever heard someone boast that he is exactly like his younger brother, who is exactly like his father, who made his eldest son exactly like himself, and sister is exactly like her mom, and her daughter is exactly the same as her mom. We all like the same things, and we think the same, and like the same music, and vote the same, and never. Individualization rocks by nature. Diversity holds the miracle of survival. It is basic science that any animal dependent on one thing for survival is doomed to follow the ups and downs of its codependent partner. So when we all become locked into the great global economy, what happens when the economy slows down? What if there should be an economic recession, and God forbid, a worldwide depression? And that is why globalization ranks third on the top 10 list of worst things for planet Earth. And now, number 2 on the top 10 list of the worst things for planet Earth, genetic engineering. Now, God only knows the complexity of DNA. It is powerful indeed. Take the DNA of a fruit fly and that of a human, and there isn't really all that much difference. Just the other day, someone altered nature's DNA to create a mouse that had no fear of cats. Great idea for the cat. Maybe not really such a great idea for the mouse. And then there are the rats that fluoresce under black lights. Do you think they could make people with four arms? They already do, only by mistake. I think it was called thalidomide. Now, there will be plenty of people who will point to the advances in crop yields due to enhanced genetic modification that produces faster-growing wheat, or corn, or trees, or people. But tell that to the South American farmer who has been self-sufficient by growing his corn as a way of life going back to ancient times, who finds himself now facing fines and his fields destroyed because that corn he'd been using is now patented by the company that was able to map and thereby patent its DNA. And you can't use that without paying the price to its owner. We are tinkering with the secrets of life itself, and they give us the power to transform life into new forms that serve very specific needs or purposes or have a power of their own that we may just not be able to understand. Playing with the mystery may unleash a demon with powers untold. Until we can create one daisy from scratch, we don't even have a clue how it all works. And let's not forget that there are the Lex Luthers amongst us who like to play and tinker with big plans for a better world. And that's why, on a scale of 1 to 10, genetic engineering ranks as the second worst thing for planet Earth. And that brings us to number 1, the top item on our top 10 list of worst things for planet Earth. And topping this list, war. Nothing even comes close to our winner of the top 10 worst things for the planet. How it is that we can sanction, condone, or participate in wars any longer is, well, complex. Most of us will probably never really understand what actually lies behind war. Throughout history, there are many reasons given for war. Conquest and riches, vanity and hate, land and beautiful women, revenge and madness. In the 20th century, power, profit, petroleum, petulance, and pride, to name a few. Nothing has ever compared to the human suffering of war. The senseless brutality of hand-to-hand combat, snipers, grenade launchers, helicopter gunships, Agent Orange, fragmentation bombs, bunker buster bombs, atomic bombs, hydrogen bombs. A most insane concomitant of war
is the absolute wastage of war. From the investments of money, manpower, and machinery to gear up for war, then the armaments expended to create holes in walls and buildings and neighborhoods and cities, big holes, gaping holes, treacherous tangles of senseless destruction. And then the rebuilding of what was destroyed. Beyond the sheer waste of human life, in every sense of the word, the most amazing thing about war is that the same people keep profiting from war. On the front side, the investors and bankers who finance the build-up to war. Then the munitions manufacturers who make expensive bombs that blow good things up into worthless bits and fragments. And then the bankers and their friends who provide the humanitarian relief and rebuild the torn cities, towns, and villages. And who pays? In every sense of the word, the people pay for war. Although it seems that people rarely want wars, they almost always are led, administered, financed, and created by a few angry and confused souls at the top. One reason I don't believe in war is that in my entire lifetime, I have rarely witnessed acts of violence. An occasional brawl amongst drunken men or women? I've seen news clips of people using violence, but mostly in relationship to a crime. But in my city of San Diego, what amazes me most is that of the 1.5 million people who live here, with a few exceptions, we all manage to get along. The freeways flow in and out each day. Restaurants feed thousands of people. Schools educate. Homes are built. And people shop and raise animals and sell wine. That is what people want. But then there are some who benefit from war, and they mess things up for the rest of us. And as we hear of wars and rumors of wars that are now extending out for 10 or 20 or more years, that is why war is the number one worst thing for planet Earth. Next year, we're going to get busy and fix all of this. It is time. Now that we know the main challenges, we can better address the solutions. With the new year, I'll be sharing the top 10 best things for planet Earth. And next week, please listen to the Santa Fe Christmas Story, a great family or children event here on the Wild Side News. So until we meet again, next Tuesday or any time on the archives, this is Sidney Wildsmith wishing you joy and happiness in the days ahead, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.